For 36 years, the Goldman Environmental Prize has celebrated everyday heroes who are showing us that every action has the power to turn apathy into positive change for the environment. Heroes like Bastiana Gurri and Olsi Nika, who helped create Europe's first Wild River National Park. Visit us at goldmanprize.org to discover the stories of this year's Goldman Environmental Prize winners. And learn how when it comes to protecting our planet, the doing makes the difference.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Head to Safeway this week for these amazing deals for members. Signature Select Classic Ham, shank half or whole, bone in while supplies last, just 89 cents per pound. Enjoy 1 pound strawberries or 6 ounce blueberries, raspberries, or blackberries. Buy two, get two free of equal or lesser value when you buy four. And mix and match Nabisco snack crackers, Ritz crackers, Cheetos, Doritos, Tostitos, or Sun Chips, selected varieties and sizes. Buy two, get two for free when you buy four. Visit Safeway.com for more details. See you in the aisles.
Hi, back on the Jeff Calkins Show. Let's do this Chris Herrington deal. Chris Herrington joins me now. Chris, what are we listening to?
That's Light of Day by Joan Jett, song written by Bruce Springsteen. I was trying to find something that mixed optimism and defiance on behalf of the Grizzlies, and that sort of hits the tone.
Yeah, I don't know that I was just thinking about, you're covering tonight's game, obviously, in person. I don't know that I've ever covered games where I just knew the team I was covering particularly was going to lose. That's not true. Memphis football, I guess I knew they were going to lose to Penn State. I knew, but it's just kind of a different... It is a little bit of a different experience, I imagine, when you pretty much know they're going to lose tonight.
Yeah, I mean, I have to go back to, the first playoff era in Memphis, where they got swept three times in a row, I think. I mean, they never got blown out to the magnitude of this, and maybe there was no individual game where you knew whether they were going to lose,
right.
You knew they were going to lose the series.
Right.
It was sort of that kind of thing. And I don't know that they're going to lose tonight. I suspect they will. I think
right.
That's highly likely.
Right.
But, that's why they played the game.
That's why they play the game. Well, there's the Dave Yeager era, that one with the gunfight with Spurs.
Oh, yeah.
Then you knew they were going to lose to the Spurs, right? We knew that.
Yeah. That was a team that earned their way to the playoffs in the regular season, but was nowhere close to them. It's still a little bit like this year, but much, much, much more extreme in that the team that got to the playoffs was nowhere close to being a playoff-level team. Not remotely.
Right. And for that reason, it wasn't ignominious, because they just didn't have anybody. I don't know who was missing. Conley was missing. Who was missing? Was Mark there?
I think Mark was out, too.
It was ridiculous. So I guess then you did, too. But anyway, so you've written a piece about Jaren Jackson Jr. We talked about it a little bit yesterday. Since we talked, Kendrick Perkins called him the most overhyped player in the league. Which seems extreme, but this is what happens when you lose by 51 and we're in a hot take universe. People start having hot takes. You wrote a considerably more measured analysis of Jaren's performance in the playoffs, which has not been good. We talked a little bit about that yesterday. But one of the things that was interesting to me was Jaren's early season performance and then his post-coaching chain performance. And I don't know if you have the numbers there, but it's pretty striking.
Yeah, no, I don't have.
I'm going to read them to people, and then you can maybe. Prior to the All-Star break, Jackson averaged 28 points per 36 minutes, shooting 50% from the floor on roughly 20 field goal attempts per 36, getting to the free throw line for 7 attempts per 36. This is again from Chris's column today, which you can read at the Daily Memphian. In 8 regular season appearances after the coaching change, averaged 22 points per 36, that's down from 28, shooting 44% from the field, that's down from 50, on 17 field goal attempts per 36, down from 20. Getting to the free throw line for 5 attempts per 36, that's down from 7. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and there's obviously some period in between there. And one of the points I make in this column is that I think the team style of play was starting to shift. I said this on the show a lot when it was happening. The team style of play was starting to shift a little bit before the coaching change. It was really after that blowout against the Knicks and then Josh set out a game or two. They came back with a commitment to we got to get Ja going and get him more engaged. And that's when I think Taylor Jenkins started working in more screen stuff. And obviously that accelerated even more after the coaching change. But just taking that like early season Jaren versus post-coaching change sample is a little bit more of a stark contrast. And it's not like, you know, it's not like some outrageous discrepancy, but it's a meaningful discrepancy.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's just a byproduct of, I do think, the emphasis on the screening actions for the guards has pushed Jaren down the pecking order offensively at least a little bit. And I think he's not – and the kind of touches he's getting fewer touches, I think, in the offense, and the kind of touches he's getting, I think, are a little bit less conducive to where he's become at his best, which to me is the ISO off the dribble – attack off the dribble, get into your floater, you know, go one-on-one, have some space to operate, not the post-ups. Everyone always wants the bigs to post up because the big, you got to get in the post. And everyone always says that.
Right.
And it's kind of lazy. And Jaren, I think, is okay in the post, but he's getting doubled on these posts. And they post him so far out that it's almost like he's quadruple teamed because he's got two defenders on him and he's got a baseline and a sideline there. And so it's almost like you're like trapped, you know, and surrounded. And I think he's at his best top of the key, you know, going downhill, and they're getting to that less. You know, I asked some questions along those lines to Isolo after their practice yesterday, and he didn't cite Jaren directly, but I feel like he was sort of, you know, answering what I was saying without making it about Jaren, where he talked about how, you know, it's not like we think about like you run the play for one shot. What we really do is you run actions that have multiple things you can get to. And the point he's making is that when the actions start with like a screen and roll between a guard and like Zach Edey, that doesn't mean it's only those two guys involved in the play. But that Oklahoma City short circuits things so much, they have a hard time getting to the other stuff off of that. And that other stuff off of that is, you know, going to be more the Jaren stuff. But that also speaks to the point of that, you know, you're having to get through multiple things to get to him sometimes instead of starting with him.
I guess what is the particular challenge that, I mean, he talked about the windows being smaller. Like, what was the particular challenge that Oklahoma City presents?
Well, they're just so awesome defensively everywhere all the time.
Right.
That you have to make quick reactions or, like, guess what? It's a turnover. They're going down the floor. And so if you don't react quick enough, certainly the doubles are already there. And if you just have to be very sharp in what you do or they're going to blow up the play before you can even get the play started.
If you were to say, like, the keys, turnovers? Are turnovers, or like, you can't shoot like they shot last time, whatever, they were 70% from three. But again, that shooting wasn't some accident either. It wasn't they were missing open shots, right? There were some that they were missing. I don't know where
they were missing open shots, but that gets into the question of, like, you know, how comfortable are you as a team? And that's something that I've talked about. I don't know, maybe not on the show, maybe on the podcast, but this idea that, somebody wrote, maybe it was Michael Pena, wrote something earlier this year about how teams shoot worse on quote-unquote open threes against Oklahoma City than anyone else in the league.
Huh.
So is that random? Is that happenstance?
No.
His theory, which I think is accurate, is you make teams uncomfortable. Your defense makes teams uncomfortable to the point that it impacts their shots even when their shots are wide open, just because you're sort of on edge because of the intensity of the whole thing. And so you make teams so uncomfortable that even when they get open shots, they're sort of shaky on them. And I do think that's what happens.
I think that totally stands to reason. You know, I have to make this three because I've got no, oh my God, I have an open three. I have to make this or we're going to get buried. Right. And so I think it makes all the sense in the world. You did go through and sort of look at the touches that he got in game one. And again, I don't know if you have those numbers in front of you either, but what did you fundamentally learn from the touches that he got in game one? What went wrong?
And this isn't like every touch he had, because that would have required me like watching the entire game
sort
of on slow motion. I didn't have time for that. But I went and watched the Jaren stuff that generated box score stats. So I looked at all of the half-court touches for him that generated a shot attempt, an assist, or a turnover. And there are other touches that he moves the ball and moves somewhere else, and you know, I didn't account for all of that. But the touches he got that generated a shot attempt in the half-court, a shot attempt, a turnover, or an assist, it was roughly an even mix of like three kind of things. It was the post-ups, the spot-up threes, and then the catch, and then you can either attack or pass. That sort of triple threat position, top of the key kind of stuff. And look, they didn't generate great stuff on any of it. Of course, they didn't generate great stuff on anything all night other than Marvin Bagley, you know, putbacks. But they generated more points per touch on the face-up, you know, attack off the dribble, you know, triple threat stuff than they did the other two. And I thought it just looked better, like the quality. Even when they didn't get even when he missed a shot, it was a good shot. I thought the quality of the stuff they got out of that was better. Now with the spot ups, it's just like, you know, are you making or missing shots, right? And for the most part, like there was one that was just, you know, it's a hot potato pass in the corner, and the shot clock's about to expire, and you just have to heave it up, and that's like, you know, not really on him. But other than that, it's just like, you know, you got a shot and you miss a shot, just like the whole team.
Then finally, you did in the midst of toward the end of this piece, again, people can read it at the Daily Memphian, you reviewed again, and you've written about it before and have alerted people a long time.
And I'll write about it again.
And you'll write about it again, I'm certain. Remind me what the contract situation is with Jaren, what's at stake, and whether he is named third-team All-NBA, et cetera.
So I came back around to that because, to me, you can't separate that from the question of his playoff performance.
Right.
That has to be relevant to this. So, Jaren, I would like to remind everyone, including perhaps the Memphis Grizzlies organization, that Jaren Jackson is under contract next season.
Right.
Like, he is not a free agent this summer. He is under contract next season. And even if he goes into unrestricted free agency a year from this summer, the Grizzlies will still be able to offer him more money and more years than any other team can. So I'm not sure, you know, that it needs to be as enormous of a thing this summer as it's become, apparently.
Right.
But they can offer him an extension. They can do a contract extension with Jaren this summer. And there are different kinds of contract extensions they could do. If he makes the All-NBA team, and I think it seems to me he's really on the knife's edge, third team or no team, he really could go either way, and we'll find out in a few weeks. If he makes All-NBA, he will be eligible for a Supermax extension, which means you can sign him to a five-year deal for up to $350 million, and that would start a year from now, and his contract next season would just be what it is, which is a pretty good contract. So that really raises the question of, like, the Supermax is not meant for Jaren Jackson Jr. I mean, that wasn't the idea. The idea is that's meant for Stephon Curry and LeBron James and Nikola Jokic. So, like, how much are you really willing to pay Jaren Jackson if he's, like, a one-time third-team All-NBA guy who's been shaky in the playoffs? I think that's a real question.
Can you offer him, by the way, just to interrupt here, could you offer him 5 years, $300 million? Can you do that under the Supermax?
I believe you can.
Okay, so you don't have to offer him the full max. You go ahead.
Yeah, and 5 years, 300 would basically be his regular max from the Grizzlies next season. If he goes through next season and goes into free agency in 2026, then the max contract from the Grizzlies, not a super max, but just a regular max contract from the Grizzlies, not from other teams, would be 5 years and close to 300. I believe that if he has super max eligibility, they could go ahead and do that. That is pretty rare. I think Rudy Gobert is the only player who's gotten Supermax eligibility and signed a deal for less than that, but it has happened, and like that's a pretty good comp for Jaren, really. So I think they should pursue that. If he does not make All-NBA,
yep,
they can still offer him a contract extension. It's based on just your current contract, your current salary. His salary is too low to do an extension off of as it currently stands, but what they can do is what's called a renegotiate and extend, where they can clear cap space, use that cap space to give him a raise next season, boost his salary next season, and then do an extension off of that higher salary. And there are ways they can get to the point there of offering him a bigger deal this summer than any other team, not the Grizzlies, but any other team could offer him a year from now. So there's lots of balls in play.
And you can both renegotiate for next year and extend for beyond that. You can do all that this summer. You can renegotiate, extend, do all those things.
Yeah. The renegotiate and extend would be limited to 4 years, so not the five. So it would be a four-year deal on top of next season. And the numbers would not get as high, but the numbers could get higher than any other team could give him a year from now. Now, to do that, to clear the cap space to do that, you're going to have to do some other things that are going to limit, you know, your flexibility for other roster moves. And I don't think that's something that's great if you want to make next year's team better.
Is having the flexibility to do that part of the justification or reason for disgorging yourself of Marcus Smart when you did?
That was the essential first piece to clearing the path. Like, the path is not fully clear, but that was the first way to clear the path. And I do think that was a component of the rationale for that trade. But as I said at the time, when people were pointing that out, they did this to re-sign Jaren next summer. A, at that point, it looked like Jaren was going to make all NBA. B, if Marcus Smart had been the player they expected him to be when they traded for him,
they wouldn't have done it.
They would not have traded him away, regardless of any of this.
Right.
And so let's remember that.
Okay. And then the larger question here, though, is that you can be disappointing in the playoffs. You can be not theoretically worth the supermax. And yet, if there's no other player nearly as good as Jaren Jackson to replace Jaren Jackson on the Grizzlies, aren't you sort of boxed into having to do whatever you have to do to keep Jaren Jackson, even if it's wildly overpaying him?
Well, that's the question. If the thing to do is $350 million, is Jaren for $350 million better than no Jaren? I mean, that's a real. There's not an obvious answer to
right.
that. Like, it's a real discussion. And then you get the other issues of, like, you know, if you don't get a deal done with him this summer and it's going to push it back to a year from now to next summer, even though the Grizzlies are in position to offer more money than anyone else a year from now, you gotta find out whether, like, Jared's waiting for that more money or he's waiting to look to get somewhere else. And so there's all kinds of complicated stuff. But right now, like, Jared's going to play basketball tonight, and, like, there's going to be a lot of eyes on him, and, like, you know, that'll be interesting to see what he does.
When we last talked to you, you said you were going to go to the availability and people would say words. And I'm sure they did say words. Any of those words stick out? And do you expect any changes in the rotation tonight, one way or another?
Well, I use some Eastwell quotes in my column on Jaren, which I had referenced earlier in this conversation. So I asked Eastwell about that, and I thought it was worth using. The players that talked were Bagley and Aldama, and Drew used some of their stuff in his piece. I mean, there's nothing
right.
really newsy in what they said. The one thing I did get out of it, and this is not, you know, if there's some betting line on who plays or doesn't play, like, don't take this as gospel. But I did notice that the way the practices work, like, guys clear out, and the guys who are left do an extra work at the end are the guys who don't play.
Right.
The quote-unquote play groups, as Taylor Jenkins used to call them. And when it got to the play group portion of the practice, Vince Williams Jr. was in the play group and Luke Kennard was not. I think that is a potential indication that Kennard might be in the rotation today.
All right. Chris, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
All right.
Chris Harrington from the Daily Memphian. You can read his piece at the Daily Memphian. If you're looking for a new financial institution, Leaders Credit Union would be the place I would send you, because it's the place that I sent Claire. It's the place I sent her son, Conroy, because I like it. Because, as I've said, first of all, the app is great. Like, you just try the app is great. That you can walk into the Bartlett location or the Arlington location, brand new location in Arlington, to set up your account there. But you can do it just by app as well. So whether you're looking for a new car loan or a new home loan, or whether you're just fed up with being nickel and dimed by your current financial institution, Leaders Credit Union would be the place to go. I hear Jason talking about they have this deal where they help to get young kids involved with their own bank account, and they give them there's money and stuff for their good grades and all of that. My kids are beyond that. I just go there because it's a tremendous financial institution. They make banking easy. It's Leaders Credit Union. To learn more, leaderscu.com/ESPN. It's Fish on Friday. On Tuesday, our man in Washington, D.C., coming up next. Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM ESPN.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of the Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to the Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, back at the Jeff Calkins Show, joined now by Charles Fishman. It is Fish on Friday. On Tuesday, Charles Fishman, of course, is a man in Washington, D.C., author of three New York Times bestsellers, most recently One Giant Leap, about the extraordinary efforts of ordinary Americans to get us to the moon, also a three-time winner of the Gerald Loeb Award for Excellence in Business Writing, a retired Mississippi River tugboat deckhand. And Charles, I have to say, I was searching the universe for good news, because it's not been abundant lately. I mean, even the freaking Pope died. So, and I settled upon Chili's restaurant as the source of my good news. Chili's is thriving?
In part because I told you it was good news.
Okay, that is partly why I settled on it. That's true, but let's not go behind the curtain here.
Let's not pull the curtain back too far. This is kind of an amazing story. There are five Chili's in the Memphis area, mostly to the east. Do you ever go to Chili's?
Isn't one of the Chili's, Jeffrey, right over there by the Wendy's and the, is that a Chili's right there near the railroad tracks?
Yeah, Poplar and Perkins.
Poplar. There's one right on Poplar. Right?
Yeah, Poplar and Perkins. You have.
Do you ever go, Jeffrey?
I go to Chili's quite frequently.
Really?
My wife likes it.
What do you get?
The triple dipper, usually.
What's that?
Oh, my God. You're playing. It's like we said it. Maybe Jeffrey.
What is the triple dipper?
You have your options.
I'll tell you what the triple dipper is before he tells you what the triple dipper is.
He knows because he knows. You know because you read it. There's
correct.
A difference.
No,
here.
Triple dipper is 15% of Chili's business worldwide. It's incredible. It's an appetizer that accounts for 15% of their total.
So what do you
sale.
Get on the hold on. Let me get talk to Jeffrey. What do you get on the triple dipper?
You get to pick three appetizers. You can also include chicken crispers. Usually what I go with is the Southwest egg rolls, chicken crispers, and the sliders.
There you go.
The big hot
bite. And that's it. I'm just curious.
What does it cost?
Do you actually need a main course after that?
No. I mean, sometimes I'll get fries with it, like ask for a side of fries. But no, we usually do.
Split a triple dipper?
No, my wife and I will split the queso and then chips and salsa. And then she'll usually order something. And then my entree is the triple dipper.
Wow. Well, so Chili's is, if you recall, from the history of Fish on Friday on Tuesday and our, I would call it expertise, if not obsession.
Right.
with what my wife might refer to as relatively low-rent restaurant dining. Chili's is an upgrade from Wendy's, McDonald's, Burger King, Chick-fil-A obsession. Quick-serve restaurants, this is a category they call QSR, quick-serve restaurants, declining 4% last year. Chili's number of diners last year up 20%. So compared to everybody else, they're up 24%. Their business, their revenue is up 50% in 3 years. And so the Wall Street Journal, of course, did a deep dive interviewing the CEO. And you know what they found was interesting? A restaurant is a kind of factory. And so one of the complaints from customers was that the French fries arrived at the table not hot enough, right? One thing you want, right. is, especially with the change in oils, you want your French fries hot, because once they're cold, they're not good anymore. They used to be good cold 15 years ago, no more. Well, they were making two kinds of fries, and that slowed everything down. So they zeroed in on one kind of fries, no curly fries anymore. And the second thing is, the instructions said that you laid the fries out on a tray, and you had to shake the salt shaker, the seasoning shaker, 30 times. And the CEO said, I tried to do it. And after five times, you're just cursing and you want to stop. He said, shaking the salt 30 times was ridiculous. So he said, we did a radical innovation.
Bigger holes on the salt shaker.
Unbelievable. That's exactly
nice.
What they did.
I got it. Woohoo!
You could run your own restaurant. So, and they have a value meal. That's incredible compared to even the fast food restaurants. Their value meal is $10.99, which gives you a starter, a main course, and a drink. Well, you can pay $10.99 or more for one quote unquote value meal.
If I drive through a Taco Bell and get a the most expensive burrito thing and a drink, it's $10. Basically, it's right. And I do. By
and
the
you're
way.
Not sitting down. Yeah. You don't get a chair.
It's not a meal at all. It's a snack, right?
It's not
exactly.
A meal. It's a snack, right? And so last year, TGI Fridays and Red Lobster, who really are Fridays especially, direct competitors, both declared bankruptcy. The organization, they're not gone. and Chili's had a surge of 20%. They're also apparently using TikTok very effectively. The Triple Dipper is a huge hit.
They're from the same TikTok category as like Applebee's too, I presume.
Right? It's Applebee's, right? Right. Same thing. Same thing.
Would be the same thing.
If I wanted to go to a Chili's here in Washington D.C., just like if I wanted to go to a Burger King, I have to drive half an hour. So I'm not going to Chili's. But very impressed.
So in other news, and I was stunned to hear this yesterday, one of the figures that we talk about on Fish on Friday on Tuesday, maybe,
speaking of deep expertise,
maybe more than any other individual name. In a lot of sports talk shows, you might be talking about Patrick Mahomes or LeBron James or whatever else. But in this segment, the person that we talk about, it seems like, more than any other, is Jay Powell. And who is, you can tell me what he is in a minute, again, remind the people. But yesterday, I read on Donald Trump's feed that he is, and this is, I never knew this before, a loser! He's a loser! So, remind me again, who is Jay Powell, and why haven't you before told us that he's a loser? He's a loser!
He's a loser. Jay Powell is the chairman of the Federal Reserve. And by the way, he's a Republican who was appointed by, do you know who he was appointed?
Donald Trump. We all make mistakes.
Yes, Donald Trump. He was appointed.
We all make mistakes.
Often it turns out that Donald Trump is fooled on first. He's fooled a little bit. Jay Powell is truly a pleasure. He's a thoughtful, smart, careful guy. He speaks beautifully, and he's running what's called the central bank. He's running the Bank of the United States of America, which is the Federal Reserve Bank. It's part of the federal government, and they do lots of things. They help keep track of the GDP of the country. They monitor manufacturing. They monitor service work. They eat. There's 12 regional Federal Reserve banks. There's a Richmond and a New York and an Atlanta and a Kansas City and Chicago. Each of those has an expertise that helps understand and explain the economy. The Federal Reserve's most public job, as we talk about all the time, is what is it, Jeff? Do you know?
To set your interest rates.
Set your interest.
But by the way, this is not the interest rates that you will pay on a home loan, right?
It's related to it, but not the actual.
He's not the reason you're paying 7%.
We never talk about this. You can't go. You're not missing out. You can't go to a Federal Reserve Bank, reel in, and get a loan.
No, you can go to Leaders, though.
You can go to Leaders Credit Union. You can't go to the Federal Reserve Bank and use their ATM. But you know who can?
The federal government.
There's actually something called the overnight lending window. It's like an ATM window for a bank.
Right.
You call up and say, it's 5:30 in the evening on Tuesday.
Right, so why is he a loser?
I need $20 million to make it to tomorrow morning. And the Federal Reserve loans it to you, but only if you're a bank. They set the interest rates that banks pay for their money, and that determines the rate throughout the economy.
I see. Does Powell set it himself, or can he be outvoted by the other members?
No. That's what's really important. He's the chairman of the Federal Reserve. He runs the organization. And there's a committee of 12 boards of members of the Board of Governors and presidents of the regional banks who meet every 2 months, I believe, to set interest rates and decide whether they're going to change them.
And is our college friend Tom Barkin on that committee?
Our college friend Tom Barkin is on that committee, and he's the chairman. He's the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. Sometimes he votes, and sometimes he doesn't. They rotate on and off.
I see. Okay.
And Jay Powell is only one vote of the 12. Now, he is in some ways the most persuasive vote. It's a little bit like being the Speaker of the House or the Majority Leader of the Senate. But he's one vote of 12, and here's the most important thing. The Federal Reserve is in a special category of U.S. government agency. It's a quasi-independent agency. It does not, Jay Powell And all the members of the Board of Governors and each of the presidents are appointed by the President of the United States. But then they serve and cannot be fired on a whim. And there's a reason for that, because the most powerful way to control inflation, as we talk about all the time, is interest rates. Oddly, the way you bring down the cost of things is by raising the cost of money. The one thing you want to do when there's inflation is increase the interest rate, increase the cost of money. That reduces ultimately the cost of everything else. But guess who doesn't like high interest rates? Presidents. And so
because,
in the developed economies around the world, there are independent central banks so that they can impose pain on us, high interest rates, in order to reduce long-term pain, which is inflation. Trump is now attacking Jay Powell, literally screaming, all caps, exclamation points, on True Social, because he wants Powell to lower interest rates. Because guess what? The economy is starting to stall. And it's starting to stall because of...
Tariffs!
And Trump wants to blame Powell. Powell doesn't want to lower interest rates because he doesn't want inflation, which we literally just got in hand in the last 6 months definitively, to take off again. And so you don't want the President of the United States to be able to fire the President of the United States.
It's an interesting deal because, like yesterday, for example, there's all kinds of reasons the market gone down. I think it's down 14 or 15% in the last 3 months. 15, 14% in the last 3 months, something like that. But yesterday it went down, among other things, because Trump was attacking Powell, at least is what people were theorizing. Because the financial markets, people who believe in stability and our economic system and whatever else, actually value the fact that we have an independent Fed because they don't want it to be controlled by politicians. When you have politicians controlling things, sometimes they use their short-term interest over their long-term interest. It's why you can't get your arms around Social Security or any entitlement spending or any federal spending is because politicians don't do unpopular things, whereas an independent agency, the Fed, might, right? I mean, isn't that sort of
exactly
it?
Yeah, exactly. That is correct.
So he's not a loser? Is that a summary? Not a loser?
I honestly don't think he's a loser. And already there are Republican senators speaking out and saying the Fed needs to be independent. He can lobby all he wants with True Social, but you want a Federal Reserve board that sets interest rates, the Open Market Committee, to pay attention to the data and not to the politics.
Okay. Before we continue on this national politics stuff, I'm going to interrupt and change the order just a little bit to leaven it with a quick, because I saw this the other day. And as someone who grew up in an age of when we feared quicksand was something that anyone could step in at any point. Like in Scooby-Doo, I'm sure there was a quicksand episode. There were always quicksand. And yet it began to dawn on you in the real world. I personally have never actually encountered quicksand. But we do have a quicksand update, and I think we should upgrade the national news to alert people to the fact that their fears to quicksand might in fact be based.
All cartoon fears.
Yeah.
Gilligan's Island never encountered quicksand, but cartoons every single Saturday, some Looney Tunes character was sinking in the quicksand. It is funny. It would be fun to go back. It's like the phrase, if we could send a man to the moon, it would be fun to go back and trace which cartoon artist became obsessed with quicksand as a storytelling mechanism. But in fact, on the beach in Leland, Michigan, which is a beach you and I
frequented
every single summer. Although it's called Vans Beach. I personally am safe because when you go to Vans Beach in July, Lake Michigan is 47 degrees.
Right. The water's still a little chilly. You don't go in.
Family does, but I don't.
Yeah.
But a couple on their first date, Mitchell O'Brien and Brianna Sika, had known each other from work for 2 years.
Yeah.
And a work colleague said to them, "You guys like each other so much. Why are you just friends? Why don't you date?"
Okay.
And it was sort of the classic, I like I like her, but I'm pretty sure she doesn't like me that way.
Right.
She was like, I like him, but I'm pretty sure he doesn't like me that way.
Yeah, right.
So they grudgingly agreed to go on the date without understanding what might happen. And they go to pick up, they were searching for something called blue stones, which aren't stones. They're kind of polished, left over from steel manufacturing that wash up on the beach. They were waste. That was dumped in Lake Michigan, and now
finally they're polished, beautiful now.
Yeah, right, beautiful, beautiful, quote unquote rocks, but they're just steel making waste. And the nearby harbor in Leland had been dredged, and for some reason the beach was completely disrupted, and there were areas on the beach of you may have encountered this, the beach of soft sand where there's as much water as sand, kind of holes where you could sink in a little bit.
Right.
And Brianna warned Mitchell, that looks really dangerous. And in classic, this probably means they're going to get married.
Right.
In classic fashion, he literally stepped right into the place she was pointing to.
And
then he sank up to his waist so quickly that he literally had to move fast to rescue his wallet and his phone from his pockets and handed them to her. And then he couldn't dig himself out. He would dig himself out and the waves would put the sand right in. And they both called 911. I'm sorry, my wife just texted me. She's catching a plane, and she's got a migraine. That's not going to work out well. She's to cancel. I'll cancel when I get off the radio. And they both called. She was really worried that he was going to keep sinking.
Yeah, right.
And he kept saying, you know what? I can't get out, and I've sunk all the way to my waist. But I can feel the bottom of the quicksand with my feet. I'm not going anywhere from here, which is kind of both scary and reassuring. Listen, as a cop reporter at age 24, I literally wrote stories about construction workers who died, who suffocated in trenches when the sand collapsed on them. So it's a little bit of a laughing matter, but you can...
Tell me the romance. Tell me the happy romance part of the story.
What happened is they both called 911 on their phones. Very poor service at this spot.
Yeah.
They would get through, get cut off. They both got through at the same time. Mitchell said, I'm stuck in the beach at Vans Beach, and I think my girlfriend is calling you at the same time. And she was off trying to get signal, 100 steps away, calling 911 saying, my boyfriend is stuck in the beach.
And upon saying it out loud, simultaneously, they became boyfriend and girlfriend, and now they're dating. Happy ending.
The Detroit News said he got stuck in the sand at the beach and emerged with a girlfriend.
Funny, the weird thing about this story is I actually saw it on some Michigan Facebook page. It's now been picked up everywhere, including by the New York Times. Because we're intrigued about quicksand or because of the meet cute part of it? Why in the world?
It could be a romantic comedy tomorrow.
It could be a romantic comedy. Okay, back to our national, regular scheduled national news. I try desperately not to talk about Harvard when I'm talking to you on this segment because, let's be honest, it's Harvard. But Harvard.
Yeah, I don't really understand.
Harvard is in the news today. Harvard is in. Can I please get the question out?
You can go.
Harvard is in the news today because it is being billions of dollars taken stripped from Harvard by the federal government. And I guess I would ask, why is the federal government just handing shovelfuls of billions of dollars to Harvard anyway? Isn't that a giant waste and it should be stopped? Good for the administration.
I had a single tweet that I typed out on my phone by hand, standing in the kitchen, because I got frustrated with this, and 2 million people read that one tweet, and this is what it was about.
Okay.
This is not, R1 research universities, the University of Michigan, the University of Texas, Berkeley, Harvard, Princeton, places that do independent R&D research, advancing the cause of knowledge in the world, astronomy, physics, medicine, science. They do get federal grants because the federal government wants us to find the next internet, wants us to create the next crazy new material.
Wants us to address Alzheimer's, for example.
Wants us to understand Alzheimer's and fix diabetes and all of that. And researchers, scientists, professors at these universities apply for grants. The federal government doesn't write a check for $2 billion a year to Harvard. They write 1,000 checks for $10 million or $20 million or $5 million. Each of those grants, so to speak, is applied for, reviewed, approved, comes with 10 pages of requirements and performance metrics, and then they write the check. If you're going to do Alzheimer's research, you've submitted the protocols. We want you to adjust the protocols this way, and instead of taking 3 years, we want you to do it in, you know, 30 months instead of 36 months, and here's your money. And then at each of the benchmarks, they're reviewed. So Harvard gets $2 billion worth of funding, 1,000 researchers at a time, 1,000 grants at a time. Each one of those grants is from an agency in the federal government, like NASA, like HHS, like the NIH, whose job is to give out money for Alzheimer's research, or to understand the universe, or fundamental physics research. And each grant, you're competing for them. You don't just get them. And so people seem to think that Harvard was like it was like a donation. The federal government said,
okay, but isn't it about isn't it about fighting anti-Semitism at Harvard? Isn't that what the basis
is? The Trump administration says it's about fighting anti-Semitism, but the $2 billion has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. There's no anti-Semitism involved in Alzheimer's research or diabetes. And yesterday, Harvard sued the federal government because they said the $2 billion had been frozen, had been suspended illegally. There, if you want to break a contract when you go to buy a house, when you contract to have your kitchen renovated, either side, you have a contract, and then you say, wait a minute, you're not doing what you said. I'm going to break the contract. Each of these grants is a contract, and there are rules. And the federal government can't simply actually cancel the funding, literally because Donald Trump woke up on a Tuesday morning and he was angry at Harvard. And so they're suing to restore the funding on a case-by-case basis while saying, if you want to talk about anti-Semitism, we're willing to admit that we weren't perfect and we're going to change that. But you can't actually cancel our contracts for diabetes research or childhood cancer research because of your allegations about anti-Semitism, which, by the way, we don't agree with, but which have nothing to do with diabetes research. But the most important thing, that's the controversial part. The non-controversial part is universities like the University of Michigan or Texas A&M or UCLA don't just get big checks from the federal government on a whim.
Right. Also, by the way, University of Memphis is an R1 research university.
Just wanted to include it.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And you can research right now. You could just type into Google University of Memphis R1 research grants, NIH or federal government or HHS or NASA, and they will pop up. It's also all public. The way this money is spent and what happens and what the results of that research are. Researcher by researcher, it's all public.
Quick.
No one wants to talk more about science than the people doing it.
We don't have a lot of time. We are obsessed with quick casual restaurants. Also, Coke versus Pepsi tends to be an obsession here. And you like eyelashes for some reason. Tariffs having an impact.
Let's do Coke versus Pepsi. What a weird thing. We talked just whatever it was, 2 weeks ago, about how Coke is crushing Pepsi.
Yeah.
Pepsi's now fallen to third most popular drink in America behind Dr. Pepper. It turns out Pepsi makes all of the concentrate for Pepsi and Mountain Dew in Ireland because the corporate taxes in Ireland are so low. They literally make millions of gallons of concentrate in Ireland and ship it to the United States to make Pepsi and Mountain Dew. And guess where the tariffs are going?
Crazy. In Ireland.
That is crazy. That is
in Ireland, and so wait. So all of a sudden, 10%. What is 10%?
Comes across the ocean, right?
In a boat.
And the tariffs, right? In a boat. And you know what? As an aside, that's what screwball tax policy does. The idea that your Pepsi in Oklahoma City, in Memphis, in Seattle is based on a product made in Ireland is just crazy. It's just insane.
But anyway, so 10% tariff?
Coke makes concentrate in Ireland too, by the way, but mostly for Europe, and also makes concentrate in Atlanta and Puerto Rico. So that is going to raise Pepsi's cost relative to Coke. Yesterday, really important, Trump met at the White House. This was very low-key.
Yeah.
With the CEO of Walmart, the CEO of Target, and the CEO of Home Depot.
Okay.
Lowe's was supposed to come but didn't make it. just those three people, those three CEOs and the President of the United States, no one said anything. The White House and the CEOs issued the same statement, essentially saying we had a very productive and interesting meeting. Those are the people you want explaining to Donald Trump what's going to happen because of these tariffs, because they live in that world every day, and we live in the world that they help create.
I read somewhere just a fleeting sentence that what's going to happen is Walmart shelves are going to be emptied of the things that are made in China, which is 60% or something of what is sold at Walmart. I mean, is that
Walmart's in a little bit of an unusual position. Walmart actually says 2/3 of its products are sourced in the U.S., but that's because Walmart's business is 60% groceries. In the part of the store that isn't the grocery store, which in most Walmarts is actually the majority of the floor space, right, is not the grocery store,
right,
even though groceries are where they make their money. People buy groceries over and over and over again. You only need back-to-school shirts.
You only need one toaster.
Shoes and, yep. Right. I think there's going to be a big problem, but also Walmart's the big dog. If you're going to give toasters to anybody, if you're going to give flat-screen TVs to anybody, if you're going to give hoses and athletic socks and underwear to anybody, you're going to try and keep Walmart supplied. But the most important thing is I'm happy that Donald Trump was willing to listen, to sit down and listen to those people. They have serious responsibilities. They can't live in a world of fantasy or BS. So that was good. And listen, Pope Francis' funeral is going to be on Saturday. You can say whatever you want about how he ran the Catholic Church. There's some controversy about that. The Pope was a voice for people who are poor, who are dispossessed, who have less power. And there are not nearly enough voices at that level of power the Pope has. There was a wonderful.
We gotta go. Jeffrey, hit the music. We gotta go. Thank you, Charles. Appreciate it. See you, Charles. On Twitter @CFishman. We gotta get out of here. Jeffrey, what's coming up next?
Here's what's coming up next.
Jeff, here's what's coming up next on Jason John. Jessica Benson joins their program. Tim Murray will be with me on Jeffrey Wright and Company. Jeff will be with Gabe at 5 o'clock.
Thanks for listening, buddy. We will be back tomorrow. For now, work is done.